This is David Duke, broadcasting to the world on Web Radio. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell upon the earth. And indeed, our people are in a great crisis. There has been a lot of controversy over the last few days, and I don't want to address the specific incident that caused some of the controversy, but I do want to talk a little bit today on some of the issues facing us in terms of Jewish supremacism as compared to the non-white threat. One of the posts that I read on one of the forums, not on Stormfront or on any of the other ones that I know very well, but another forum talked about that, asked the question, an open-ended question, you know, what is the bigger problem, or what's the thing we're most concerned about? Is it 100 African third world immigrants living in our neighborhood, or is it 100 Jews or Jewish extremists living in our neighborhood? And the interesting thing and the issue is that people tend to ignore is the fact that those 100 immigrant third world Africans wouldn't be in the neighborhood at all, except for the fact, and we've got a call, but I'm not going to take it. Let me see if I can deal with it. Yeah, I'll just tip it on down. So, okay, let's get back to our issues. It's been crazy about here. You know, I tell you, when I come back to the United States, it is a madhouse. I have so much work to do, so much to catch up on. I left some of my teaching, obviously, overseas. I've got some individuals who are waiting for me to get back and do some more lectures to finish the course. I've got so many things. I've got a number of engagements that are pending overseas and in many places around the world. And I've had some engagements here. I want to tell you, recently I had a scheduled engagement on Fox News, on the program that's on Saturday evening. I don't even remember the name of the program at this point, but they called me last Thursday, and they invited me in the program, and they told me that I'd be back. They made arrangements. They said I'd be down there. It's for 8 o'clock, an 8 o'clock evening program. They're going to hook it up by live satellite from New Orleans. So I prepared that in my schedule. They said that they would have one of the editors of the program, one of the producers, call me and give me a pre-interview. I guess that's to try to find out what you believe so they can try to refute what you say during the broadcast and give their announcer a lot of ammunition. My advice, by the way, to nationalists who appear in these kinds of programs is to don't give them too much, to be pretty much tongue-in-cheek, because you know, that's giving them a little bit of an advantage over them. I'd like to pre-interview the people who interview me so I know exactly what their positions are. And then you go out, you try to find the weakest points of their argument and debate them. Of course, I've heard these arguments so often. I don't think there's many weak points in my debate. But it was an interesting situation where they invited me. They said they were going to send even a car over to the North Shore to pick me up for the interview. They had a studio arranged. And then at the last minute on Friday, they called me back and said, well, no, we couldn't get the studio that we hoped to, and we'll just have to take a rain check on it. We'll do this program another time. The issue was on freedom of speech, and we were going to discuss the student, or the teacher in, I believe it's Colorado, who said some things about George Bush, and they were going to discuss some other issues on freedom of speech around the world, and they knew that I was a speaker around the world who had faced a problem of being repressed and being kept from exercising my freedom of speech. In fact, even possibly facing imprisonment in some countries. So I was ready to do the show. I was ready and loaded for bear, but at the last second, the show was canceled. And that's kind of typical. And it goes often with the entire Jewish supremacist structure. If you find, for instance, in a local paper, this was my experience years ago with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, you'd have a situation where you might have a reporter, maybe liberal, but he's an honest reporter. Or maybe he's somewhat conservative. If he keeps that pretty quiet in the media these days. But still, there are some liberals who are basically honest, and they really believe their old journalism classes, where they said that you report a story, you know, fairly. You answer the questions who, what, when, why, where. You discuss what these individuals who had this meeting or this speech, what they've said. You know, the way it happens to me with a lot of these medias today, I give a speech and I'll speak for an hour and a half, and you see the television journalism, they'll have more words from the protesters outside dishing me and just calling me names than they'll even show of my speech, even though they recorded the whole thing. In fact, they're looking for something in that speech, any sort of line or word or some sort of a mistake or an error or something said intemperately, and they're trying to air something. But they'll have more from the protesters who just come out there with a picket sign than they will from my actual speech itself. This was the case around Louisiana when I was running for governor. It was so often I would, and the U.S. Senator, I'd come into a town, we'd have a huge crowd with 4,000 or 5,000 people, and in many towns you'd have a smaller crowd, but still 1,000 or 2,000 people. The local media would come out, and they would tape the speech. The people in the crowd, of course, were incredibly enthusiastic. It was great, great audio, great video. It was great television, to tell you the truth. And the news would, take this down. And then you'd watch the news report, and they might show 2 seconds of me talking, and they would show 10, 15 minutes of interviewing the, quote, anti-Nazi, anti-Klan coalition or something in the outside of the building, making all these outlandish statements, saying all these hateful and terrible things, and even threatening violence against me. But they wouldn't even give me a minute to even let the people hear during the course of this campaign what my campaign issues were. However, the word got out. You know, people spread by word of mouth, and they learned what I was saying that way, and that's one reason why the meetings were so crowded. But what happens in a lot of these situations is you'll have a decent reporter, and they'll come out and they'll do a story and do some interviews, but then it has to go to the editor, and then it goes to the producer, and so often you get the Jewish supremacist or the person again committed to the Jewish supremacist line, the Jewish supremacist ideology, and then they simply edit the story and chop out, you know, the places where you're lucid and the places where you make some very powerful points, and only leave in the parts that they think are best for their side. And they can even edit out your answers and even make the interviewer look like he got the best of you when it's the other way around. I remember the Good Morning America show with Geraldo Rivera, and that was one of the most vicious things I've ever seen in my life. He interviewed me for an hour and a half, but he only ran about 5 minutes on the program. It was 5 minutes that he chose, and it wasn't even a consistent 5 minutes. He would basically chop off my answers in half. He would insert himself in other sections. He would give different answers I had to different questions that he had, but he'd run it over like it looked like it was just a basically continuous tape, but it was absolutely a complete hatchet job, and it was a complete lie. I remember the PBS special he did years ago about the Border Watch. Now, long before there were Minutemen, we did some border watches along the Mexican-American border, and we made it very clear to the media that we were not carrying guns, that we were simply, at that time we used CBs, we didn't have the cell phones, but we were simply going to report through our CBs and network that, you know, where the aliens were coming and report this to the Border Patrol so they could come pick up the aliens. We planned not to arrest any of them ourselves, but simply to report where they were crossing the border. This was primarily in Southern California. We also did some in Arizona and Texas. And, there was a documentary made by PBS, and they came. And long after I was in California, first they showed me on the documentary. In fact, let me go ahead and give you a little framing of this program and the propaganda. I'll give you a framing of it by saying that I had a good friend at the time, J. Deborah Kirkpatrick in Memphis, Tennessee. He had a very large and successful law firm, and he told his secretaries to watch the documentary. And one of the secretaries came back the next day and she said, well, a lot of what David Duke said made a lot of sense, but But I was just shocked about how he was so deceitful. He lied. How he could lie the way that he lied. And J. Deborah Kirkpatrick said, "Well, what do you mean about that?" She said, "Well, in the broadcast, it showed David Duke saying that none of his people would have any weapons. They wouldn't have any guns. And then they showed the people on the Border Patrol going out and loading the guns into their car and so forth with David Duke's T-shirts and meeting about it and cleaning their guns and talking about it." And ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what they did. They didn't take guns to the border. What these media people did is they went to some of our people's homes in Southern California, and they talked about the fact that the communists had made physical threats against them and threatened violence against them and their families. And they asked them, "Well, do you have weapons to defend yourself? Do you have any guns, legal guns, to defend yourself in your home?" And they said, "Well, of course we do." And they said, and these people were not media savvy. They were not experts. They didn't know how they were being manipulated. And in fact, they were these are country people, and they are very proud of the fact that they have beautiful rifles and shotguns and all the rest of it, and they keep them in good form, and they were very proud of that fact. And so they said, "Well, we'd like to see what you have, and we'd like to see you cleaning your guns and so forth to show that you're prepared in case somebody tries to bother you. And if you do target shooting, we'd like to film you target shooting." Of course, again, that's the kind of image the media was trying to create. Well, these guys fell into the trap, and they polished their guns for the cameras while they're talking to them. And while they were doing it, the reporters started to ask them questions about the border watch while they were polishing their guns. And then they showed them going out to their automobiles and putting the guns in the trunk to go to the firing range. But the way it appeared on the program was that they were loading guns in their trunks to go to go on the border watch, like they were going down there to shoot Mexicans, which is absolutely, of course, incorrect in any facet. Our people were strictly instructed. In fact, our cars were inspected, and there were about a million police all over the place in Southern California at the time when we had the biggest event. And these people had no weapons whatsoever. But if you watch this documentary, which was made months later, you would think that here I am saying, yes, our people will be unarmed, and they'll be they're not going to do any sort of violence or whatever. In fact, nobody in our organization would ever do anything like that, and they would be removed from our organization if they did. And so they show me saying they're not going to be armed, and the next thing you see is they're talking about the border watch polishing their weapons, and then they're shown going out in their regalia, T-shirts and all that, putting the weapons in the trunks of their cars and then driving into the night. And again, so the image made it appear like, well, there's David Duke, the big liar. The media can do anything they want to do. But what happens in a lot of these media and broadcast programs, and it's a lot of the newspaper articles too, if you have a fair reporter who does something, makes a decent interview, asks you decent questions. In fact, I've met quite a few in my life, and a surprising number, actually, who've agreed with what I've had to say. And I've had a few of them write some pretty decent things and print some pretty decent things, but a lot of those things that they write never get into print because the managing editors, for instance, the Times-Picayune, I've had this happen, Times-Picayune, where a reporter came out and they write down the meeting and what I said and what we're all about and decent interviews with our people. And then the managing editor sees that this story actually makes us look good in the minds of most of the people. So they just either cut the story entirely, or they edit it down where they only put the one paragraph in that's negative. Like if you're in a room that has 1,000 people cheering their hearts out, you find one person in the back of the room who's skeptical or angry or has a nasty word to say about the speaker, and then you simply quote them, and then to the public, you get this image that the people were there skeptical, that this man has no support among the public. These are the kind of tricks that they use. And this media control just goes on, and this is one area that the Jewish supremacists are able to dominate because they just permeate this establishment. So even when you run into someone who's fair on the lower level, and there have been some Jewish reporters who've been fair to me, not many, but a few. But on the higher level, there's these watchdogs, and they basically are able to edit or to deep six anything that they don't want the public to see. So it's a fine process. And I think this happened in this program that I was going to be on in terms of Fox. They planned on having me on then, and they realized, well, some websites actually talk about my appearance on Tim Russert on Meet the Press and about how this is the way you beat Tim Russert. you know, David Duke shows you how to beat them. And this, they use my program. Some of these liberal different media think tanks use my program to teach people how to be able to stand up to Tim Russert because I defeated him so badly. But you know, the issue is kind of interesting. That's one reason why I like live shows so much, because when you have a live show, they can't tape it. They can't cut it so easily, and you know, what you see is what you get. There's not much they can do about it. All Tim Russert could do there was just steam by the end of the program, and it was kind of interesting. Even at the end, all of his interns, all the people, the young people working for him in the show, just were so nice to me afterward. It was just totally amazing. They were just so friendly and saying, "Man, you really got him," and we'd never seen anything like this, and it was great. But again, when you get into the media that is edited, when the media is that's recorded, and when you get into things such as the newsprint, where your upper management and editors have something to say about it, then you have that filtering system which takes place. And there's just so many of these Jewish supremacists in these roles ready, always on guard for issues that are important to them and their people. When I had the problem at the conference recently, and this one Jewish person stood up and started screaming at me, you know, this with frothing with hatred. I mean, just absolutely unbelievable, calling me a Nazi, which is kind of interesting because the leader of the conference was called that exact term by the anti-racist action people, the basically Marxist demonstrators who are outside the function, and here's somebody inside calling me that. And they acted like, because I asked a question dealing with some of the issues of the Jewish extremist role in undermining Europe and the early Islamic invasion, which is a historical fact, by the way. They opened the gates at Constantinople, they opened the gates at Granada, and they certainly opened the gates of Western America and Europe and Western civilization over the last 20, 30 years. They've been the primary driving force behind changing the immigration laws in the United States of America and around the world. And their media, of course, has pushed this in the same way. And my question was to the speaker, you know, how do we oppose this internal subversion? He was going to be allowed to speak. And then this person rose up. And these were just facts. He just rose up and began to flail at me, as you know, and actually using obscenities to do so. And so what happens? I get trouble from it. Of course, some people criticized him. Absolutely, I think most people there, you know, liked what I said and were interested by it and were looking forward to the answer. But some people were saying, "Oh my God, I'm a troublemaker. You know, David Duke's a troublemaker." Well, I'm not a troublemaker. I was asking a legitimate question. But the interesting aspect is this. It seems, and this is something that's very true when you deal with the Jewish supremacists, and some Jewish supremacists also agree with us that there are racial differences, but they also believe that they are supreme and they have some sort of, you know, godly right or some sort of right by might to rule over us. They really believe that. In fact, and they get, you know, if you talk about anything that doesn't fit their agenda, they get upset, they start screaming, they become totally intolerant. Yet, you know, we at the conference, as usual, it's the white folks, you know, that it's the other way around for us. I mean, I don't take it personal. There's no reason for this person, by the way, to take it anything personal, I said. I didn't take it personal, the fact that some of the speakers said that Asians have a consistently higher IQ than Europeans. I didn't take it personal when a couple of the speakers, you know, commented that Jews have even higher IQs, that Jews have a higher IQ than Europeans. Now, I might go into some of the reasons for that later in this broadcast, and I might go into some of my arguments about that later in the broadcast, but the point is, I didn't take that personal. I didn't get up and start screaming, and nobody, in fact, in the room got up and started screaming or felt like they were being personally attacked because this was being said. The individual in question would have done much better simply to say, "Well, you know, we must acknowledge these things are true. There's been an antagonist position between the Jewish community and the Christian community over the centuries, and the Jewish community often did side with the Islamics. In fact, the Jewish community became the administrators of the very oppressive regimes that existed in Spain and in Turkey and the Balkans and many other places." you know, that's just a fact. And he could have said, and now there are some of them that are being torn from that because they see a great danger in the Islamic immigration. He could have done something like that. But he chose to act in a very stereotypical way. And now we find the criticism that I'm enduring because of it. You know, ladies and gentlemen, we have a situation that we've got to realize that we cannot let the Jewish supremacists steer our intellectual white community into the camp of the neocons. And we really have got to, and I'm not talking about that conference, because I think the conference overall was great, and I think it's great that we have so many race scientists and people going to these things, and I think it's also a big encouragement to people to go to these things. And people might argue, well, it costs a lot of money for hotel room, and it costs a lot of money for airfares, and boy, we could use that money a lot better. Well, I have a feeling that money wouldn't be spent anyway. I don't think that money would be coming to us in contributions. Most people who came there could afford it, even if it was a little bit of a strain at the time of the conference. But it pays off in dividends, because when people go to conferences like that, they get charged up, they get excited, they become more passionate, the movement becomes more real to them, the issues become more real to them, and they realize that it's not just something where they're clipping a little coupon out of the mail and sending back a return envelope with some money in it, that they're actually involved in an issue that's real, and they're talking about the very survival of their people. So that's kind of interesting in this issue. Now back to the issue on the immigrants. I mentioned, he said one of the emails I read, or the posts I read, said that, you know, which are you more concerned about, 100 immigrant third world Africans in the neighborhood or 100 Jewish extremists, you know? And I tell you something, you've got to realize, and the way I would answer that question would be that the 100 third world immigrants, Africans, would not be there except for the Jewish extremists, who have been the driving force of egalitarianism, of open immigration, of forced race mixing, and really the dominators of the media and Hollywood, which has fostered all of it. The multiculturalism, the diversity propaganda that we are drowning in today. And we can also cannot ignore the political influence they've had on these issues. And in fact, even the Jewish press has pointed out that 50-75% of all the political donations on the main races come from Jewish sources in the United States. That was in the Wall Street Journal. So they've not only have been the leading intellectual and media advocates of our demise, they've also had enormous power as well to affect that demise. Now, a good example of an expression of their power is the Academy Awards last night. I tell you, it was painful, but I tuned in, and while I was doing some work on my computer, I turned in the Academy Awards just to see if anything interesting took place. And of course, it was filled with diversity, immigrant type, and minority propaganda all the way through it. And of course, the Academy and the motion pictures is literally, it's like a Jewish phenomenon. There are Gentiles around, a lot of Gentile actors, and Gentile actors sometimes are better suited to pursue and to promote the Jewish agenda than Jewish actors, because we identify more with Gentile actors. If we're an overwhelmingly Gentile country, 98%, and with people that look like us and sound like us and feel, you know, that have kind of our persona rather than the stereotypical Jewish persona, whatever that is, obviously if they start promoting the Jewish supremacist line on things and the Jewish supremacist image on things, that's more effective for them to do that, to convince us to follow this line, and then for them to do such a thing. So these things are permeated also as Gentiles, but there's no question about the Academy Awards that they're dominated by Jews, and that's who's deciding and voting. And there's been many studies about this. The great vast majority of the writers, producers, directors, they dominate the Hollywood establishment. I don't think that this is proof of any superiority. I think that it's maybe proof of of an inferiority of a sense. And I'm not saying that, but it's proof that they certainly don't have our culture, because Hollywood is just so full of such trash today. Well, what were the movies? What were the major films who were fighting it out for the best picture? Well, of course, the three, I guess, the top fighters in this category And there were four, by the way, if you include the one on Edward Murrow, because he was anti-McCarthy. That's a favorite Jewish theme, is against Eugene. McCarthy, who was the great anti-communist crusader, in the 1950s. But if you look at the three films, you had Brokeback Mountain. And that is a film which really attacks the most basic Gentile, white Gentile persona of America, the cowboy, an image of our masculinity, of our heritage, of our culture, the great solid cowboy. Here they are portrayed as homosexuals, you know, and so forth. I mean, just this is Hollywood. So that was one of the choices. Another choice was Transamerica, about a sex change operation, some deviant. And then another one was Crash. Crash was a movie that was absolutely, viciously anti-white. It just portrayed white people as treating blacks terribly and awfully in so many ways. And it basically talked about it showed one black man rising up, you know, and fighting against this terrible oppression of white people. They show one scene where this white officer filled with racial hatred sexually assaults and on a simple traffic stop. Not only does he stop a black man unjustly, but he sexually assaults his wife right in front of him. I mean, it's just a very vicious thing. And he's portrayed very viciously in this issue. And could you imagine the other way around? I mean, we have a situation where so many white women face the specter of being raped by non-whites. I mean, it's an epidemic. It's not simply something where white women face 50% more or 100% more rapes by blacks than vice versa, but it's literally thousands of percentage points. I mean, white women are 30, 40, 50, 100 times more likely to be raped by blacks than black women are to be raped by whites. But can you imagine that kind of portrayal where a black individual, a black police officer, sexually assaults the wife of, you know, of the white wife of a white man, and so forth, viciously and evilly. I mean, it's just incredible, ladies and gentlemen. It's just not even thinkable. But this is the kind of thing. It's a self-hating issue. The movie was called Crash, and ultimately this Hollywood Jewish community chose Crash to win the awards. And I tell you what, at this very moment, the Jewish extremists who run Hollywood and so much of the West lead our people to a crash of epic proportions. And it's very, very sad. Also, I mentioned in one of my posts on Stormfront, I talked about the fact that the best song, the award, the Academy Award for the best song, was this is going to knock you over, my friend. It was called It's Hard... Hard Out Here Being a Pimp. It's Hard Out Here Being a Pimp. That was by 3-6 Mafia, gangster rap songs. And there you go, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, that's the influence of Hollywood. And now this song was done by degenerate, you know, African gangster rappers. But think about this, my friends. It was promoted, it was financed, it was popularized, and it was awarded and recognized as great, you know, great culture for our people by Jews. Now, why can't every one of our people begin to get it? Gangster rap musicians, you see, are not the problem. Without the problem of Jewish supremacy, supremacism, they wouldn't even exist in our society. They certainly wouldn't be the epic or the cultural norm of our country. That's the way we have it right now in this country, and that's the way it is. I want to mention something else. This is kind of an interesting point. During the conference, as I told you, that was talked about a lot how Asians had a higher IQ. And let me tell you something. I'd be the last person to ever denigrate the IQs or the intelligence of Asian people. They're very smart people, and they're capable people. And I've been to Japan before. I've been to China before. You know, I've been to Southeast Asia. I taught many Asians in Laos during the end of the Vietnam War. I taught Laotians, Chinese, Vietnamese, Thai, even some of the Montagnard people, which weren't quite as smart as the, as I tell you, the Chinese group seemed to be the smartest of those that I taught over there. Vietnamese were pretty intelligent, too, in terms of my student classes. They are smart people. There's no question about that. But there's also no question about, on a per capita basis, that Europeans have been far more creative. We've created, you know, tremendous numbers of European art and literature, music, architecture. It's fantastic scientific, medical, technological achievements. It's been amazing what we've produced. And in one of my discussions with one of the scientists at the conference who's on the cutting edge of these research, he said there's two main factors, you know, in dealing with creativity and dealing with the ability people have genetically to create and to establish new ground and scientifically or historically or in the mental categories. See, one is G, and that's basically the elemental category of intelligence. The G factor is basically, if an intelligence test, every intelligence test is affected somewhat by environment and somewhat by your educational experience. But G is that native ability simply to reason, that native ability of intelligence. And in fact, the more a test is G-loaded, by the way, the more we find it tends to be hereditary rather than genetic. In other words, when you take a test when it's like verbal questions, we find that tends to not be as genetic as a test where you just have the manipulation of numbers or symbols that don't have a cultural aspect. This you find a much more hereditary aspect or component to those kinds of tests. But there's another factor. It hasn't been talked about yet, and hasn't been talked about extensively yet, by the way. It has been talked about and written about by many different people around the world, but it hasn't been studied in nearly the same intensity that G has been studied. And this is a factor which is called the P factor. And the P factor is a very interesting issue. It seems if you have a high intelligence and you have a low P, you tend not to be very creative, and you also tend not to be very aggressive. And if you have a high intelligence and you have a high P, you tend to be very creative, but you also have a tendency, or many people have a kind of tendency, to be schizophrenic or to be a little crazy and scatter. I'm just, you know, strange. And it's kind of like an interesting phenomena. And Asians have apparently a lower P. They have a high IQ, probably higher average IQ. They don't also have probably the extremes in the greater variation that we do. Whites have a variation where we tend to have more less intelligent people, and we also tend to have more people in the very highest echelons of intelligence. So overall, we get a higher proportion of super high intelligent people than they do, even though their IQ is a few points higher than ours on average. But definitely, Europeans have a higher P, which is good and bad. It means we're more aggressive, and we have more tendencies probably toward crime and things of that nature, and violence. But at the same time, we tend to also be extremely creative people. It's the same kind of aggression. You might say that if you combine it with intelligence, it gets somebody maybe into a fight or be confrontive. That also is an intelligence that lends people to aggressively try to find a cure for this disease, or aggressively conquer Mount Everest, or have this incredible sense of aggression and goal of going to the moon. So it's called the P factor, the P factor. Now, the question for me, you know, whether or not Asians are more intelligent is really not an issue. We definitely have our distinct characteristics, our distinct heritage and values as Europeans, and we certainly want to preserve them. And at the same time, we certainly respect the Asian communities and the Asian people to preserve their way of life. I don't consider ourselves better. I consider ourselves different, and I consider ourselves better for us. In other words, we are best suited for our own culture, our own society, and we're happier at home. We're happier in a society that resembles our own people our own values, our own culture, and those kinds of issues. And I think the truth is it will always be that way. And I believe that unless we begin to work very hard to defend our own heritage and our own culture, that we're going to lose them. In fact, we are losing them. But tonight I just wanted to address for a few minutes some of the issues of Jewish supremacism and point out, you know, that the demise of the, you know, just like the gangster rappers who were given the Academy Award for original song, which will influence our kids and many other kids to listen to this garbage music and this cultural destructive music. You know, these gangster rappers, they didn't give themselves their own award. They didn't, you know, they didn't finance, they didn't produce, they didn't direct, they didn't distribute. You know, they didn't promote this music. The people who really promoted it were the people in the music industry, which is overwhelmingly Jewish, and many of these Jews obviously support the Jewish agenda, and whatever that might be. And again, they work very hard for what they see as an advantage to Jews. Now, why they promote something like gangster music as their advantage, there is an answer to that, is that they feel when this kind of thing is promoted, first of all, I think they feel that they're benefiting, that they're kind of weakening their host nation, they're weakening our own traditions, our own values, and they're taking away our young people's sense of community, their sense of togetherness, when they got our young people gyrating or dancing or singing to these gangster rappers. I mean, don't you think it might have it does, in fact, it has a continued effect on their other sorts of outlook, on what they value and what they believe in, what they associate with, what they identify with. And it's at the same time, the Jews don't concern themselves as much with that because they have such an interwoven and tight community. I read something the other day that a great percentage of Jewish children go to exclusively Jewish schools. And if they don't go to Jewish schools, they go to an intense Jewish training. And they also are intensely acclimatized to the idea of being a Jew and the fact that Gentiles have oppressed them for all these years, the Holocaust and all the rest of it. In fact, they can just pay attention to normal media. I don't think the media did tremendous attention on the Holocaust is simply a matter of them trying to influence Gentiles. I think it's also a matter of influencing Jews that say we've got to support Jewish causes, we have to support Israel, we've got to, you know, do whatever necessary, we've got to suppress people like David Duke or Don Block or whoever. Kevin Stromover talks against them because, look, you know, this is, but it basically organizes and solidifies, in fact, gives great solidarity to the Jewish community and helps lessen their purse strings and helps lessen their own sense of community and their own sense of their own destiny. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've enjoyed being with you today, and I look forward to being with you this week. It's great being back home for a while. I know I've got to go back to Eastern Europe soon, but I tell you one thing. It's great being in our country. I enjoyed the conference very much, and I think Amron's doing a great job, and I like Jared Taylor, and I hope that all of us will continue to support their work, and also will continue to understand through our own publications and our own ideas and our own websites and our own articles at davidduke.com and other areas that there is a serious problem on this planet with Jewish supremacism. And the reason why we have these other problems of immigration have basically and directly been spawned by this other problem, the problem that we're not supposed to talk about. And I'm not saying that we should have any pogroms or any sort of oppression against anybody, but I say that we Europeans must start to defend our own heritage and our own culture the same as these Jewish advocates do so for themselves. They advance their own interests naturally. The people in Israel work for Israel's interest. Well, that's normal and it's healthy. Any nation should be that way. The Palestinians work for the Palestinian interest, of course. You know, and I think the same thing is true. The American people must have a government that works for our own interest. The other day, Mr. Bolton, who's a representative of our government, spoke before AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And he spoke before this group, and this is a group where some of its leaders are on trial for espionage against the United States of America. This is a scandal that the man representing our country in the United Nations would speak before this group with loyalty to another country and who's been and whose members have been charged with espionage against the United States. It's just an absolute scandal, but it happens. And the reason why it happens is because, first of all, they can, because these Jewish supremacists have so much control and influence in the political process, they can do it with immunity. Then these other politicians aren't going to complain or condemn them for doing this. They wouldn't dare. They lose their campaign funding. And they can do this without the media jumping down their throat and say, what are you doing speaking at AIPAC, which is an organization for a foreign country and an organization whose some of whose top officials have been charged with espionage against the United States of America. Now, you know, if we had a fair press and we had a government that was in our own interest, that those kinds of statements would be made after the speaking of our American representative of the United Nations, Bolton, spoke before this organization and basically spoke in a way that defended the Jewish agenda, and that Jewish agenda is ultimately a destructive attack against Iran, and if that attack takes place, it will throw this country into economic turmoil, probably economic depression in the world, and it'll cause untold economic sorrows and harm to the American people and people around the world. It will also throw this world into a storm of blood, and it will unleash terrorism like you never ever considered before. And these people are maniacs who are controlling our foreign policies, and we must gain control over them again if we are going to survive as a people. This has been David Duke, and I certainly look forward to being with you again tomorrow. Thanks a lot.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukeorg.